The discourse this afternoon, our remarks are about study 7 in volume 2, which is entitled The Parallel Dispensations that Brother Harry touched on there just a moment ago. Now, we've been studying this chapter, as many of you have, certainly longer than I have, but I've been studying this chapter for the past 40 years or more, and we find that this chapter brings and presents special challenges, and it also presents and gives us special blessings. So our objective today is really to identify and discuss some of the challenges and also some of the very special blessings that have resulted from our meditations here. In today's remarks, we plan to cover 6 points. They are listed as 2.0, 3.0, and 5.0 through 8.0 on your handout, which has been posted. And the handout really serves as three functions. First of all, it's a roadmap. We're going to be following the roadmap rather closely. Secondly, it is a list of references if you wish to study further, because most of the references on there we will not be quoting or even citing for that matter, but they are references that we looked at in preparing these remarks. And also this handout functions as a distillation or a summary of just some of the high points that we thought that might be useful for the friends to have in paper form. So the 6 points we'd like to cover today are as follows. First of all, to whom do the Mishnah and the parallels apply? Secondly, what are the key scriptures that construct the Mishnah and the parallels? Thirdly, what were the Bible students' expectations relative to the glorification of the church in 1914? Fourth, what mental adjustments do we need to make or not make to the text of this chapter 7, the parallel dispensations chapter? Fifth, how did the true church become part of the original dialogue in this topic? And finally, what is the importance of this study to us today in 2021? So we introduce our first point with a question. Who do the Mishnah and the parallels apply to? The initial answer is easy. It's Israel. But the more difficult answer is, which Israel? Because the Bible identifies not one, two, or three, but four different Israels in the text, in the scriptures. The Bible identifies each of the first two Israels as a house. A house is a collective body, a house of Israel. Two separate collective bodies is how the scriptures identify this in Isaiah 8:14. Isaiah 8:14, and he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stumbling, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel. Now, Isaiah here is not talking about the northern house of Israel, what we know as the 10 tribe or northern kingdom. And he's not talking about the southern or the 2 tribe kingdom of Judah. That's not what he's referring to. He's referring to two entirely different bodies of Israelites at two entirely different points in time. The first house is the entire body of fleshly Israelites. We might simply refer to them as fleshly Israel. The Jewish house, a body of Jews. The second house is the entire body of spiritual Israelites. We call them spiritual Israel, or the Christian house, if you will. Again, a collective body of Christians. Now, the Bible further divides the Jewish house and the Christian house into what we might characterize as two different apartments. Each house has two apartments. The Jewish house has two apartments in it, and the Christian house has two apartments in it as well. Romans chapter 9, verse 6. Romans 9, 6 reads, "They are not all Israel, which are of Israel." Now, that language is a little bit unusual, perhaps, but Paul's point, we believe, is this in Romans 9, 6. Not everyone is a true Israelite, whether you're talking about fleshly or spiritual, who professes to be a true Israelite, whether spiritual or fleshly. That means that there are four different Israels, because each house has two apartments in which dwell both the true Israel and the professed Israel. So we have four different names that we sort of conveniently refer to identify these four different Israels. We call them nominal fleshly Israel, true fleshly Israel, nominal spiritual Israel, and true spiritual Israel. Incidentally, there's a bit of background noise coming through, so I'm not sure if it's disturbing anyone else or not. It's okay with me, but if your microphone is on, you might want to double check that, please. Thank you. Now, the Mishnah and the parallels apply to only two of the four Israels. They apply only to the two nominal apartments, as we're referring to them today. All right, so we see that the Mishnah and the parallels don't have any application to individual faithful Jews or individual faithful Christians. So in our study, one of the first points we want to stress here is that we need to leave the true members of the body of Christ out of the discussion in terms of who is the discussion about, who is the topic of this discussion. Reprint 5950, and there we read, the parallels affect merely the nominal Jewish house there and the nominal Christian house here, end of quote. Let's look at our second point. For our second point, we consider four key scriptures that form the foundation of the Mishnah and the parallels. The first one is contained in Jeremiah chapter 16, and the full scope of verses would be 9 through 18, but we're only going to look at a few of those verses, 16, 9 through 18. Jeremiah 16, 9. And there we read, for thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will cause to cease out of this place in your eyes and in your days the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride. Now, Jeremiah here in 16:9 is predicting that fleshly Israel would be cast out of their land. And they would be silenced. In other words, the voice of mirth, the voice of joy, the voice of gladness. It's going to be silenced because they're going to be actually evicted from their land. This refers, we believe, to AD 33 and also the events that follow, the terrible suffering that nominal fleshly Israel would experience after AD 33. If we look briefly, we won't read them, but in verses 10 through 12, again, we're still in Jeremiah 16, verses 10 through 12, we see that these verses explain that Israel's idolatry and their unfaithfulness are the reasons that they are evicted from their land. It's the reason that their joy is silenced as a result of this eviction process. Verse 13, Jeremiah 16:13. Therefore will I cast you out of this land and into a land that ye know not, neither ye nor your fathers. And there ye shall serve other gods day and night, where I will not show you favor. Now that we can look back on Israel's post-AD 33 history, and we see their international scattering, you know, we know that this entire prophecy is dealing with Israel's period of disfavor that began at the time of our Lord in AD 33. Prior to AD 33, Israel had never been deported to unknown lands. Prior to AD 33, the nation of Israel as a nation was never devoid of divine favor. But here was a turning point in AD 33. Verses 14 to 16. Again, we're still in Jeremiah 16. Jeremiah 14 to 16 is a message of hope to fleshly Israel. In other words, they're scattering. What we call their diaspora, they're scattering all over the globe, is temporary. God's going to regather Israel in ways that will eclipse the notoriety and the amazement of Israel's miraculous exodus from Egypt. God is saying essentially in verses 14 to 16 that if you think Israel's exodus was amazing, was extraordinary, and indeed it was, well, watch this. Watch how I orchestrate the events of earth to regather natural and fleshly Israel. Verse 18, and first, I will recompense their iniquity and their sin double. Mishnah, because they have defiled my land, they have filled mine inheritance with the carcasses of their detestable and abominable things. God is saying here in Jeremiah 16:18, he says, but before I regather you, that's the word first, I will recompense. In other words, I'm going to regather you, but first, before I do that, before I regather you, I'm going to first cause you to suffer a Mishnah of punishment. A Mishnah merely means a repetition. It's a duplication. It means a span of time that matches the preceding span of time. Since their Mishnah is a period of national disfavor, their prior period is a period of national favor. In other words, national Israel's disfavor was to be an exact counterpart to their prior period of national favor. So Jeremiah, in simple words, he's talking about two halves, two equal halves. He's talking about the back half, which is the later half of disfavor, is equal to the length of the front half, or the first half, of favor. Two equal halves. We believe and understand that national Israel's existence began when the last of the patriarchs died. We know that we're very well aware of the patriarchal age. And the last patriarch of that age that died, of course, was Jacob. Now, beginning with Jacob's death, God began dealing with and favoring the 12 tribes collectively. Remember, it was the one man at a time age during the patriarchal age, but that changed with the beginning, with the time of Jacob's death, because God then begins to deal with and begins favoring all 12 tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel collectively. He's favoring them not as individuals, but he's favoring them as a nation. God gave the 12 tribes lots of favor. He gave them prophets. He gave them instruction. He gave them protection. He gave them discipline. He gave them priests. He gave them judges. He gave them kings. And finally, God gave national Israel the greatest of all gifts, the greatest of all lights on earth. He gave them his own son, Jesus Christ. And what did they do? Whom they flatly rejected. And they not only rejected, they murdered. And they chose instead to continue with the abominable sacrifices. That rejection and that election to continue with animal sacrifices, the typical sacrifices, rather than to accept the one true sacrifice, was the last straw. This would be the turning point. So Jeremiah implies that it was at that point that their Mishnah, their duplication of punishment, would begin because of their unfaithfulness, because of their idolatry. Jeremiah tells us that there would be a Mishnah that suggests its length. He tells us why there would be this Mishnah, and says it starts when Jesus is rejected as the one true sacrifice. So we learn a lot about the Mishnah from Jeremiah. So Jeremiah 16, 9 through 18 gives us a fairly complete outline of nominal fleshly Israel's Mishnah. However, there are points that Jeremiah does not give us. Jeremiah does not tell us specifically when the Mishnah begins, because as we recall, nominal fleshly Israel, through their leadership, rejected Jesus over a period of several years during his earthly ministry. So we can't pinpoint the date that the Mishnah begins from Jeremiah 16 alone. So that brings us to our second Mishnah text, which is Zechariah chapter 9, verses 9 through 12. Let's start with verse 9, Zechariah 9:9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. Now, the event that Zechariah is referring to here is absolutely unmistakable. It's given to us in very plain language. It's clear and it's specific. The New Testament, as well as reliable secular history, are also clear that it was on Nisan 10, AD 33. It's the day that we today call Palm Sunday. That's the date. That's the day. That's the specific day that Zechariah is referring to. On that day, as we recall, Jesus publicly rode into Jerusalem on a white mule and officially offered himself one last time to national Israel, nominal fleshly Israel. So this prophecy foretells nominal fleshly Israel exactly what to expect. They weren't to expect this grand gladiator of sorts. Notice how Zechariah describes him: a righteous king, a humble king, a lowly king, but still a king. So Zechariah is saying here, when this humble king offers himself to you, rejoice and accept him, because he is your salvation. He is your true salvation. Verse 10. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen. And his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from river even to the ends of the earth. Now here in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 10, Zechariah is implying that Israel did not take his advice. In other words, you have to read between the lines, between verse 9 when he says, accept this king, and verse 10 when he says, I'm going to cut you off. Because there's an implication here. And the implication between the two verses, reading between the lines, so to speak, is Israel rejected. They didn't take Zechariah's advice in verse 9. So verse 10 tells us two distinct consequences that nominal fleshly Israel is going to suffer as a result of rejecting their king. First, God cuts off or terminates nominal fleshly Israel's strength. He makes them defenseless. He cuts off the bow, makes them defenseless against their enemies. And this disfavor would apply across the board. It would apply to all of nominal fleshly Israel. Zechariah here identifies the northern or 10-tribe kingdom of Israel as Ephraim, and he identifies the southern or the 2-tribe kingdom here in this verse as Jerusalem. So the point is that this cutoff, this punishment, would be for the entire body of fleshly Israelites. The second consequence of rejecting Jesus would be that he speaks peace to the heathen. Now, the heathen here, we believe, is nominal spiritual Israel. They're called heathen because they are comprised mostly of Gentiles, and Gentiles were known as heathen. Now, at the point where God begins fleshly Israel's disfavor, he begins to favor nominal spiritual Israel. And this is exactly what the Apostle Paul reiterates in different language in Romans 11:25, where he says that fleshly Israel is disfavored until the fullness of the Gentiles, be come in. So we see this correlation here between nominal fleshly and nominal spiritual Israel. Now, during the same span of time that nominal fleshly Israel is disfavored, nominal spiritual Israel, here again identified as the heathen, is favored. So on the 10th of Nisan, God began to favor nominal spiritual Israel with the same kind or categories of favor that he had been giving nominal fleshly Israel. He began to favor nominal spiritual Israel with instruction, with guidance, with the heavenly calling. Recall Jeremiah's words that for a period of time, nominal spiritual Israel was a golden cup in the Lord's hand. So they were in this position of favor, but of course only for a limited period of time. Verse 12, Zechariah 9:12. Turn you to the stronghold, ye prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double Mishnah unto thee. Now, nominal fleshly Israel is the prisoners of hope that are referred to in this verse. Why? Because Zechariah told them in the prior chapter, Zechariah chapter 8, that they, fleshly Israel, would be restored at one point. Nominal fleshly Israel was a prisoner to the Roman oppression. They were a prisoner to sin. They were a prisoner to punishment. So that's why that's the reason for this word prisoner in this verse. But they were prisoners of hope. They're characterized as prisoners of hope because even though they're in prison, they have hope of getting out of prison, because of Zechariah's assurance of their restoration. Now, the stronghold that Zechariah refers to here in verse 12 is Jesus. Zechariah is foretelling nominal fleshly Israel to accept Jesus as their king, to accept him as their Messiah. Turn you to the stronghold. In other words, accept him. But Zechariah clearly implies, again, reading between the lines here, Zechariah clearly implies that nominal fleshly Israel will reject Jesus as their salvation, as their king, as their Messiah. Why do we say that's implied? Because look how verse 12 ends. He says, today do I declare that I will render double. He ends verse 12 by declaring that nominal fleshly Israel's punishment begins now, today. So here's what we get from Zechariah's prophecy. Zechariah pinpoints the very day that nominal fleshly Israel's Mishnah of punishment begins. Remember, that was the point that we didn't get from Jeremiah. It begins the day that Jesus rides into Jerusalem on a mule and is rejected by the leadership of fleshly Israel. Recall that Jeremiah 16, again, did not pinpoint the day. Jeremiah just said that it would be when Israel rejected Jesus. So Zechariah zeroes in and he pinpoints the day that nominal fleshly Israel's Mishnah begins which again would be Nisan 10 AD 33. This is the very day that the New Testament record shows that Jesus declared that famous statement, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate," Matthew 23:38. So if we put these two prophecies together, Jeremiah 16 and Zechariah 9, we learn and are assured of three things about the Mishnah. We know the exact day the Mishnah began, and we know the exact day that it ended, or the exact year that it ended, 1845 years later in AD 1878. We know that 1878 ends the Mishnah because, again, because of the very definition of a Mishnah, is it has to be a match. Mishnah, the Mishnah matches the time span from Jacob's death to AD 33, which, as we know from our chronology studies, is 1845 years. Now, we also know that nominal spiritual Israel's favor is concurrent with nominal fleshly Israel's disfavor, because that's what Zechariah is telling us. So we know, again, just to recap very quickly, three things from these prophecies. A, the date the Mishnah began. B, the date that it ended. And C, that nominal spiritual Israel would be favored during this very same span of time that nominal fleshly Israel was disfavored. Let's consider our third Mishnah text, our third Mishnah prophecy. This is from the oldest of the three prophets, Isaiah, chapter 40. Look at verses 1 and 2. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, and that her iniquity is pardoned, for she hath received of the Lord's hand double. And here the word is not Mishnah, it's Kephel. But it substantially means, pardon me, the same thing as Mishnah. It's a fold, Kephel. Shall receive of the Lord's hand double, or Kephel, for all her sins. Now, ironically, Isaiah's prophecy is a message that one Israel is giving to another Israel. True spiritual Israel is here giving a message, a God-authorized message, to nominal fleshly Israel that's collectively called or referred to as Jerusalem. So the message is simple, that true spiritual Israel is giving. Nominal fleshly Israel, your Mishnah, your time of punishment, your Kephel, was for a limited time. But now the time has come for it to end. Your hardship is over. Your Mishnah has paid off your debt, your punishment. And so now it's time to begin your earthly favor. So based on Jeremiah 16, Zechariah 9, and Isaiah 40, we know that 1878 marks a major turning point for both nominal Israels. For nominal fleshly Israel, 1878 was to be the time of beginning of their restoration, their return, not to spiritual favor, but their return to earthly favor. That's marked by two very significant historical events that are ironclad. First of all, the Berlin Congress of Nations in 1878 is God's exclamation point on this turning point that was reached for nominal fleshly Israel in the year 1878. We also have in 1878 another marked historical event, well established, and that is the founding of the first modern Jewish settlement of Petah Tikva. By the way, Petah Tikva is a thriving industrial center today, so it wasn't just a flash in the pan back, 125 years ago or more. So for the first time in centuries, the Jews were permitted to own land in the Promised Land, and they were permitted to begin to resettle, to recolonize there in the Promised Land. That's the major turning point in 1878 relative to fleshly Israel. But 1878 also marks a watershed event, a sea change event for nominal spiritual Israel as well. Nominal spiritual Israel, as we mentioned, was to be favored. It was to be the golden cup in the Lord's hand, but only so long as nominal fleshly Israel was disfavored. Remember, nominal fleshly Israel is a picture. It is a type of nominal spiritual Israel. So just as nominal fleshly Israel had its period of favor followed by a period of disfavor, so the same conceptually would happen to nominal spiritual Israel. After their period of favor was over, they would then begin to be disfavored. And that disfavor, we believe, can be well marked by a historical event that's been well recorded. In 1877, a 26-year-old Pittsburgh businessman presented the truth to nominal spiritual Israel here in southwestern Pennsylvania. And what did they do with it? They rejected it. They weren't interested. So what happened the very next year, 1878, the Lord rejected nominal spiritual Israel. As we all know, Revelation 18:2, Babylon is fallen. There's the judgment that was entered against them. So 1878, we believe, began a chain of events that ends with the total destruction of Satan's system, nominal spiritual Israel. Our fourth core scripture is Daniel chapter 9, verses 23 to 27. This is not a Mishnah text, but we suggest that it is a parallel text. Now, this is a good place, I think, to pause for just a moment and make a distinction between what's the difference between the Mishnah and the parallels. Well, the difference is the Mishnah provides us with the 1845-year time span that began with Jacob's death in 1813, runs up to AD 33, and then from 33 to 78. That's the two halves we talked about. So we see that the Mishnah provides us with that 1845-year span of time where nominal fleshly Israel is disfavored and nominal spiritual Israel is favored. The parallels show us how we apply the 1845-year period of time to connect related events in both of these Israels. So the parallels are the connections. The parallels show us three sequential events that occurred with nominal fleshly Israel between AD 29, time of the first advent, and AD 36, the time of Cornelius. Each of these three has its counterpart, or has its parallel, if you will, in nominal spiritual Israel 1845 years later, which extends from 1874 to 1881. So in a word, the Mishnah gives us the 1845-year time span. The parallels are how we apply the Mishnah, is how we would suggest we make a distinction between the two. So back to Daniel chapter 9, verses 23 to 27. These verses describe an event on which we base the third 1845-year parallel connecting both of the nominal Israels. Now, you might recall that we studied Daniel chapter 9, verses 23 to 27 in detail in volume 2, study 3. That's regarding the fulfillment of prophecy at the time of our Lord's first advent. But for purposes of today's remarks, we're not going to go through that entire chapter, obviously. We're going to limit our treatment of these verses in Daniel 9, 23 to 27 to just the parts of pertaining to the parallels. So let's start with Daniel chapter 9, verse 24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. We recognize here that Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, is speaking. And God, through Gabriel, here assures us that nominal fleshly Israel would have 70 weeks, which we know is 490 literal solar years, of particular favor. In verse 25, Daniel 9:25, Gabriel tells Daniel that 490 years of favor would begin with a very special decree, a very special edict, if you will. And that decree was to rebuild the walls of the city of Jerusalem. Now, history records the date of this event very well. It reflects that this kingly decree to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem were given to the Israelite Nehemiah in 454 BC. Daniel 9:25 also tells us that week number 69 out of the 70 weeks would end with a very special favor, a dramatic favor, and that would be the advent of the long looked for Messiah. Messiah the Prince would come at the very end of the 69th week. Now, we know this is Jesus, and we know he was anointed in the fall of AD 29 when he reached his 30th birthday. In verses 26 and 27 in Daniel chapter 9, we understand and learn that Messiah would be rejected, and not just rejected, but he would be cut off. He would be killed in the middle of the 70th week. And we know today, no question, that date that he was killed was AD 33, in the spring of AD 33. Now, we know from Zechariah 9 that we just looked at that Jesus cast off nominal fleshly Israel in AD 33, just a few days before he was crucified. But Gabriel assures us in this assurance here in Daniel 9 that the favor would continue in some way for another 3.5 years after Jesus died. And that additional 3.5 years takes us up to AD 36. The 1845-year parallel to that is the year AD 1881. 1881, we suggest and understand, marks the date that all residual favor to nominal spiritual Israel would end in that year, 1881. All right, so we now have a scriptural basis to see three related events between both nominal Israels, the events of which are exactly 1845 years apart. Let's look at each of the three very quickly. The first event, the first set of related events begins with AD 29. Jesus presents himself as bridegroom and reaper to nominal fleshly Israel. And he did the very same thing upon his second advent in 1874. He presents himself as bridegroom and reaper to nominal spiritual Israel. Again, that was part of the favor they would get exactly 1845 years apart. The next, the second one, is in AD 33. Jesus presented himself as king to nominal fleshly Israel. And at his second advent, which was 1878, he presented himself as king to nominal spiritual Israel. Again, 1845 years separated these two events, these two related events. As king, Jesus judged and he cast off nominal fleshly Israel in AD 33. And he judged and cast off nominal spiritual Israel in AD 1878. Again, 1845 years separated these two events. The third related event or set of related events begins with AD 36, which marked the end of all residual favor to nominal fleshly Israel. And likewise, 1845 years later, 1881, marked the end of all residual favor to nominal spiritual Israel. So we see that all three of these parallels that are all scripturally based, they're based entirely on the 1845 year long Mishnah. AD 29, 33, and 36, for nominal fleshly Israel, each have their corresponding events of a similar character 1845 years later in AD 1874, 1878, and 1881 for nominal spiritual Israel. And by the way, this is nicely diagrammed for us in volume 2 on page 219. That's 219. There's one other correspondency between nominal fleshly Israel and nominal spiritual Israel that we want to note. And this is derived from Daniel chapter 9, verse 26. Daniel 9, 26 in part reads, after Messiah is cut off, that is to say killed, the people of the prince come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now we know that Gabriel here in Daniel 9, 26, we know now at this point in history, that Gabriel was forecasting the Roman army's destruction of the capital, Jerusalem, and also of Herod's temple, the second temple. And this occurred in AD 70. This event devastated nominal fleshly Israel because Jerusalem, their beloved Jerusalem, was their capital. It was the core of fleshly Israel's existence. And also, even more so, was their temple. Again, it represented the very core of Jewish national existence. So when both of those are destroyed, both the city and the temple are destroyed by the Romans in AD 70, we can see that this would be quite a dramatic event. And this is exactly what Gabriel, we believe, was referring to in Daniel 9:26. Now, nominal fleshly Israel's devastation does not have an 1845-year time parallel to nominal spiritual Israel. However, while there is no 1845-year time parallel, there still is a correspondency because nominal fleshly Israel's devastation certainly typifies, it beautifully pictures the smiting of nominal spiritual Israel by World War I in 1914. You know, some historians and some Bible scholars say that this relationship between the smiting of the Jerusalem capital and the temple in AD 70 and the smiting of nominal spiritual Israel in 1914. Some Bible scholars and historians suggest that this relationship is underscored. It's strengthened by the fact that both happened on the exact same month and day, obviously not the same year, but the same month and day. And they suggest that the Gentiles, which would be the Romans, of course, destroyed the city and the temple on the ninth day of the Jewish month of Av in the year AD 70. And corresponding to that, the Gentiles, which I guess would be basically the Germans, began the destruction of nominal spiritual Israel on the 9th of Av in 1914 with World War I. Now, regardless of whether this specificity is accurate or whether the Lord intended us to note this very detailed piece of specificity, the fact of the matter is that the destruction of fleshly Israel, their capital and their temple, clearly pictures the beginning of the destruction of nominal spiritual Israel. Let's introduce our third point out of our six with a question. What were Bible student expectations relative to the year 1914? Well, first of all, we say that technically this point is totally irrelevant to our subject because the parallels don't pertain to the true church. However, this bit of Bible student history is important because it sets the context of our fourth point that we're going to discuss here just in a few moments. Between 1874 and 1916, the Bible student community went through three different sets of expectations relative to the glorification of the church. The first phase of Bible student expectations after 1874 relative to the glorification of the church extended up to 1904. Now, the expectation was that the complete glorification of the body of Christ would occur in about the year 1912. An early edition of Volume 3 on page 228, not our current edition, but an early edition of Volume 3 reads as follows. The deliverance of the saints must take place before 1914. Now, this view that the saints would all be glorified before 1914 is confirmed and actually fine-tuned and further explained in a watershed reprint, which is 3389, published in July 1904. Reprint 3389, quote, our previous expectation, again, this is the view up to 1904. Our previous expectation was that the anarchistic period would last some 3 or 4 years. And in our mental calculations of the opportunities for harvest work, we naturally cut off those years. And the time thus appeared shorter to us. End of quote. Now, if we read this entire article, 3389, it reveals the following reasoning relative to the expectations again, prior to 1904. The lease of power to the Gentiles, the kingdom of this world, would end late in the year 1914. The end of that lease meant that Satan's systems would be totally obliterated before 1915. Armageddon was going to be the vehicle that would operate to fully evict Satan's systems before 1915. Armageddon was expected to last a very short period of time, only 3 to 4 years. And the Christ was not thought to actually go through the Armageddon trouble. So if Armageddon lasts 3 or 4 years and it had to be finished by or before 1915, and if the Christ glorified would not go through it, that meant that the Christ had to be all glorified, all beyond the veil by about 1912. 1912 is about 3 or 4 years before 1915. So this timeline would enable the Christ to be completed. It would leave about 3 or 4 years remaining to finish the Armageddon work. And it would also allow Christ's administration fully in place and governing the world in peace. The peaceable kingdom would begin before 1915 and would continue onward. So up to 1904, the true church expected to be all glorified by 1912 and the mediatorial phase of the kingdom established by 1915. Here's the point. All six studies in the scriptures were written before 1904, when the Bible student community believed that the church would be completed and fully glorified by about 1912. Now, notwithstanding the 1915 corrections that were published in reprint 5649, and notwithstanding the 1916 forwards, we want to note that remnants of the pre-1904 view still appear in the volumes that we read today. We've given you a number of references on your handout where you can look at that. So this reflects the viewpoint that the true church would be glorified by about 1912 or so and Satan's kingdoms obliterated before 1915. Now, the second phase of Bible student expectations about church glorification is that it would be finished at the very end of the Gentile times. This view extended the full glorification of the church by about 2 years. So it's not a lot different from view number one, but extended it from 1912 to 1914, the end of the Gentile times. Bible students held this view for about 10 years, from 1904 to 1914, as reflected in the towers that were published between those years, 04 and 14. Again, reprint 3389 is a watershed reprint because it declared the harvest of the true church was a full 40 years, not 38 years. The anarchy that would eliminate all vestiges of Satan's systems would follow October 1914 for about 2 or 3 years or so. Obviously, the late 1914, when it came, didn't result in the realization of these expectations, which led to the third view. The third phase of Bible student expectations is that the true church would not be glorified until an indefinite date after 1914. This is the view that's reflected in the 1916 forwards and studies in the scriptures, and also in the 1915 and 1916 towers. This is the correct view. We believe that it's not, what couldn't be understood then, but it's understood now. Matthew 24:36 says that you and I aren't going to know. Jesus says, you and I aren't going to know in advance the date that the church will be completed and the peaceable kingdom begun. Now, with this backdrop of Bible student expectations in mind, let's consider the fourth point of today's lesson. We introduce our fourth point with a question. Do we need to make mental adjustments to the text in the parallel dispensations chapter? The answer is yes, because the author's answer is yes. Why? Because not all of the text in chapter 7 reflects the 1916 viewpoint. On page 5 of volume 2, 1916 forward, Brother Russell makes a general corrective statement about the parallels chapter. If we paraphrase this general corrective statement, it is, and he says, we drew a false conclusion. The parallels apply only to the nominal systems and not to the true church. He then concludes by saying, this explanation will help the reader as he studies the time is at hand. Now, this statement implies that some of the text in the early view, which was later corrected, needs to be adjusted by the reader. We know that reprint 5649 sets forth a series of corrections in volumes 2 and 3, but it only has one correction that's offered there for the parallels chapter. So here's the point. Reprint 5649 did not make all the corrections that the author felt were necessary. But the author did not rewrite the parallels chapter in 1916, just like that very same author, the editor of the Watchtower, did not in 1916 rewrite all the Tower articles published between 1879 and 1914. If reprint 5649 had made all the corrections that the author felt were necessary to make in the parallel dispensations chapter, there would be no need for this general corrective alert in the 1916 forward. We would just read it, you know, read what's there. The implication of this general corrective statement is that you and I are charged with a responsibility. We are charged with making the needed text adjustments as we read through particularly this chapter. The challenge to you and me, of course, is what adjustments do we make and what are those adjustments? We introduce our fifth point with a question. How did the true church get into the parallels chapter, into the dialogue in the first place? You know, after 1914, great stress is laid on the importance of getting the true church out of the parallels discussion. Reprint 5950 couldn't be more emphatic on this point. And we quote, time and again, here we see the stress, time and again, we reminded our readers that the parallelism between the Jewish age and the gospel age could not include anything belonging to the new dispensation. So our fifth point is to identify and step through the rationale that initially led to the true church being tied into the parallels to help us to understand, you know, the perspective. Fortunately, because of the honesty of the author of Studies in the Scriptures, we don't have to guess about, you know, how the dialogue got involved, how the true church got involved in this discussion. We just have to read. Reprint 5950 helps us. And we quote, we imagine that the harvest work of gathering the church would be accomplished before the end of the Gentile times. But nothing in the Bible so said. Our thought was purely an inference, and now we see that it was an unjustified one. This harvest work belongs to the new dispensation, and cannot be identified with the old. End of quote. 1 month later, we know, October 1916, the Volume 2 foreword was written, and there, once again, Brother Russell referred to this unjustified inference as a false conclusion. So the rationale, that is to say the thinking up to 1914, that produced this inference between this association between the true church and the parallels goes something like this. The end of the Gentile times in October 1914 means that Satan's system must be completely destroyed either then or within just a couple of years after 1914. Many scriptures could be interpreted to suggest that the true church must be complete before Satan's system can be smitten, because it was thought that the church had to be fully glorified, all 144,001 beyond the veil, because it was to be the agent, the divine agent to do the smiting work. Texts like Psalms chapter 2, verses 8 and 9 and Daniel 2:34 could have been reasonably interpreted to support this view. The Mishnah and the parallels appeared to further support this inference that the church must be complete before or around the time of 1914. Again, in AD 70, nominal fleshly Israel was obliterated. That's a historical fact. And some 1844 years later is the end of the Gentile times, and surely it was thought nominal spiritual Israel would be obliterated by then. Well, since it requires the full glorification of the church to obliterate Satan's system, it was thought the church must obviously be fully glorified before the smiting occurs. So in a word, what brought the true church into the parallels was an incorrect connection to and a partial misunderstanding of the Gentile times that obviously was corrected after 1914. So what changed? Well, 1914 arrived. The church is still not glorified. Yet 1914 witnessed the beginning of the smiting of Satan's system. Thus, what did and did not happen in 1914 made it a matter of historical evidence that the church glorification had no connection to the Gentile times. The completion of the true church is not related to or dependent on the Mishnah or the parallels or the Gentile times. There's just simply no connection. Reprint 5632 that was published in February of 1915 says that even though the church was not complete in 1914, the Lord's kingdom smote the systems in September 1914. So reprint 5632, once again, is a watershed reprint, because it officially and clearly disconnects the full glorification of the church from the end of the Gentile times and from the parallels dispensation topic. We introduce our sixth and final point with a question. What's the importance of this chapter to us today in 2021? Why should we be interested in spending hours? This is a difficult chapter. It's a complex chapter. It's a chapter we have to do a lot of studying. And furthermore, it's about two nominal systems. Why are we interested in spending all this time and effort to understand what happens to two nominal systems? Why are we interested in struggling through all of this? The answer is found in the last four pages of Study 7, pages 242 to 245. And the answer comes in two words. This is our words, not what's there. Independent confirmation. This study independently confirms key time features of God's plan that we've studied in chapters 1 through 6 in volume 2. Two quick examples of how the Mishnah and the parallels independently confirm the conclusions that are reached and that we have studied and adopted in chapters 1 through 6. Example 1, we know that Messiah has two advents, as we've mentioned. Daniel chapter 9, together with historical record, proves that Messiah came. The first advent was in AD 29. Now, Israel's Jubilee law and also Israel's Jubilee prophecies prove to us that the Messiah returned in 1874. The two advents are exactly 1845 years apart, as we mentioned. So here's the point. The Mishnah and the parallels independently prove 1874, because the parallels are not dependent upon the Jewish law or the Jewish prophecies, the Jubilee law or prophecies. So the Mishnah and the parallels verify that we have the correct understanding and that we have correctly applied Israel's Jubilee Law and Israel's Jubilee Prophecies relative to 1874. Example number two. The Mishnah and the parallels independently verify that the Bible chronology in chapter two is not Brother Russell's chronology. It's God's chronology. Critics have been attacking God's chronology expounded by Bowen and Russell for more than 125 years. Reprint 1974. Quote, many are the false chronologies in our day. End of quote. This is true just as, this is just as true today as it was back in Brother Russell's day. The false chronologies often disagree and take issue with the true chronology in three areas: the period of the judges, the period of the kings, and the period of desolation of natural Israel. Every one of these three periods are within the 1845-year period of favor of nominal fleshly Israel. That 1845-year period of favor establishes the length of the period of disfavor. It establishes the Mishnah. The perfect symmetry, that is to say, the parallels between nominal fleshly Israel and nominal spiritual Israel, depends on the Mishnah. If you change any one of those periods, Judges, Kings, or Desolation, by even 1 year, there is no Mishnah. There are no parallels. There is no symmetry. For example, if we shorten the period from Jacob's death to AD 33, and we just shorten it by 1 year and make it 1844 years instead of 1845, and yet we know that AD 33 to 1878 is 1845 years, the Mishnah is destroyed. Friends, we urge, if we don't remember, if we don't take anything else away from these remarks today, we urge us to remember this one point. God is the one who created and gave you and me his chronology that's expounded, not created, but expounded by Bowen and Russell. God not only gave us his chronology, he gave us something else. He gave you and me the formula that proves, that verifies that it's his chronology. And it's the right one, because obviously it's his. That formula is the Mishnah and the parallels. And they work, and to our knowledge, they only work with this one chronology. You know, God knew that the dates 1874 and 2874 that the result from our chronology studies would be a vital point of faith for us. And God foreknew that there would be many critics that would challenge his chronology and devise many chronologies of their own. And there's all kinds of variations on the chronology out there. So God created this ingenious formula called the Mishnah and the Parallels to prove which chronology is his. It's the litmus test, friends, to prove which is his, which is the genuine, and distinguishes it from all others. Well, we bring our lesson on the Mishnah and the Parallels to a close by recapping 6 points very quickly. The Mishnah and the Parallels pertain only to the two nominal Israels, the two collective bodies, the two systems, the Jewish system and the Christian system, and not to true individual Israelites. This study is for the true church. It's for the edification of the new creation, but it's not about the new creation. It's not about the true church. Point two. The Mishnah and Parallels are founded on the rock-solid Bible prophecies in Jeremiah, Zechariah, Isaiah, and Daniel. The Mishnah and the Parallels are not the same thing. The Mishnah is the 1845-year time span. The Parallels are the application of the Mishnah. Third point, Bible students have held three different expectations about church glorification: the pre-1904 view, the view from 04 to 14, and the view post-14. And because parts of Study 7 still reflect the pre-1904 view, the author has recommended and advised us and counseled us to identify and make mental corrections. The author himself has charged you and me with this privilege and this duty. Point five, the true church was initially tied into the Mishnah and the Parallels based upon a partly incorrect understanding of the Gentile times, which of course was corrected after 1914. And point six, this study is vitally important to our faith because it's God's way, it's his way of putting a lock on his chronology, on the key time features of his plan, by assuring us that these features are his and they're no one else's. We conclude our remarks here with the reading of Revelation 22:10. Revelation 22:10. And he saith unto me, seal not the sayings of this prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand.